You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Well, thank you all for coming. This is very cozy. I feel it's like coffee talk.
It's coffee talk.
It is, yeah. Coffee talk.
Chat amongst yourselves.
No big whoop.
So this is capping our book tour and our first trip officially as the SGU to the UK. And it really has been a tremendous amount of fun. It's been a lot of work. We calculated that we've done 10 events in 10 days.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Thank you. One guy is impressed. I was impressed. I mean, and we really didn't repeat really much of any content over them.
No, the only thing that repeated over and over was you yelling at the rest of us.
Yes, that's that was very, very much necessary.
Wait, before we start,
yeah.
I have a question for the audience.
Yeah.
If the queen farts, is that a noble gas?
All right, yeah, they're worth
they
it.
They never
answer. That's just our test for the audience. Where are we going to aim this show on the humor?
Clearly polite.
We didn't use that in Cambridge last night.
Clearly polite laughter. All right.
So, my God, we've been to Edinburgh, Manchester, Cambridge, as we said, and now London. Everyone is so nice. You know,
yeah, which you're making us Americans look like crap.
No, like, are we all assholes? Earlier this evening, I was trying to squeeze in a little bit of tourist time, and I was trying to see the Tower of London, which we drove by, but like, I wanted to actually go into it. And I accidentally wound up as part of the Brexit march, the anti-Brexit march. It was kind of hard to avoid. I hear there were 700,000 people part of the march. Pretty impressive. I'm an American, so I'm like trying not to take any strong political positions on that. But good for you guys for getting out there. But it is strangely comforting to know that America isn't the only country in the world that's totally f***ed up. And we were thinking about, what's the differences between America and the Great Britain? And, you know, obviously we know everything I know about England I know from BBC America.
But and Monty Python.
Right. And Monty Python, you know, Benny Hill. Right, the classics.
Benny Hill, man, when he slapped the bald guy, I think that's where I got the from, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but that's so demeaning when you do that to me, Jay. Stop it.
So, we wanted to notice as much as we could. What are the differences between American skepticism and UK skepticism? But we kept encountering a little bit of a language barrier, right? So actually, what we thought we would do to get started, just to make sure there's no miscommunication during our show, is to give you a very, very quick guide to some American phrases that you may not be familiar with. You may have heard, like, all the time on the show we use the word lit, right? Like, oh, that's so lit, right? You hear me saying that all the time, right, Jay?
Oh, yeah.
That was totally lit.
Every other sentence.
So the British version of that would be, that's the bee's knees. There we go. Or spiffing, right? That's a current Britishism, right? So do you use the word ambulance, like an ambulance? So,
is that the word?
The British version of that would be the horizontal meat lorry.
Horizontal meat lorry.
Right? Did we get that right? Just so you know exactly what that means.
It works.
All right, but there's a couple more complicated ones here. All right. So this is a term that, like, even if you watch American television, you may not know exactly the nuances, the connotation of the phrase, a walk in here, right? You may hear, we have a little bit of a New York accent, so occasionally these phrases come out. But this is as close as I can get to it, like a really spot-on British translation. Let me see. I say, pardon the interruption, but I do believe the Queen's laws entitle me to the right of way. Now, there's a good chat. Right? Did I get that right? Is that good?
Nailed it, Steve.
Yeah, we're doing well here.
All right. I think I got one more.
Yeah.
Yippee-ki-yay. Kara's from Texas. You know Kara. She says that all the time.
Yeah.
Almost always with the MF-er at the end, because that's, like, almost obligatory.
The expanded version, huh?
I am chuffed to bits at the prospect of your imminent defeat and humiliation at my hands, wanker. All right, so now I think that out of the way, I think you guys will understand everything that we're saying.
All right.
I wish, I wish Bruce Willis actually said that.
Right. No, that's what, who was the other guy? Snape. You know,
Yeah,
he said that. All right. It was actually fortuitous. We actually planned on having a little bit of a movie segment because, you know, because Kara's not here. So we're going to geek out a little bit on movies when she's not here to, like, roll her eyes at us. But I think, Bob, you had this idea, right?
Was I think so. I had a lot of good
Jay's
ideas.
Idea?
It was my idea.
Oh, it was Jay's?
Yes.
We've got to tell the idea.
Don't touch me.
Well, I mean, it really started, we were on, you know, we were driving around the van, a lot of van driving. And we get bored in the van, and I turned to everyone, and I said, you know, what movie would you like to see a sequel to? Like just as good as the first movie. That's how I put it.
Right.
You know, so it's the movie that you love, but they made another one, and it's just as good. It's not embarrassing or
it's not a crappy sequel.
Yeah.
What would it be? What would be your first
choice?
For me? Yeah, no. I'm just rephrasing the question. Because I'm going first, because my slide's up.
Fine.
Yeah. So.
Steve's picture there.
Yeah. I chose The Golden Compass. Anybody here see The Golden Compass? Yeah. So that. No, it was a great movie. I like the movie.
We have a critic.
Did you read all the books, though? That's the question. So
the books.
The books were amazing. Books were amazing. It's really, I mean, it's so good. It's one of those things where it's hard to do it justice. If you're a purist who, like, thinks the movie should be exactly like the book, you're never going to like any film of a book ever. Right,
that's not true. The first Harry Potter movie.
That's because it was the book.
That's what I'm
saying.
It was
literally a screenplay of the book.
Are you high? You just contradicted yourself.
That was an anomaly.
It was because the screenplay was almost exactly.
Yeah, because the book was super short.
I know, that's right. But most of the time, the books are too long to make into a screenplay straight. You have to adapt it for the film. Yeah. So I liked it. But here's the thing. I was really looking forward to the sequels because the second and third book, I mean, they get better and better. Yeah. I mean, if they did as good a job in the first movie for whatever it was, but of the second and third book, those would have been awesome movies. But they just died on the vine.
Because nobody liked it.
No, that's not true. There was complicated politics involved. I mean, obviously, if it was hugely popular, that would have overrode everything else. Mm-hmm. It didn't do as well at the box office as it needed to do. Right. But I would love to. I was looking forward to the sequels to that movie. I was very disappointed that they didn't make them.
Great.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I read the books. I wanted to see those books in film.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right.
Oh, man. Bob loves this movie.
So in honor of Halloween, I felt I had to pick this movie. I hadn't even seen it until like 4 years ago. It was like years later, a couple years later. I thought it was a typical, cabin in the woods, teenagers go, they have sex, and somebody kills all of them. Just typical baloney. Then I realized that Joss Whedon did it. It's like, okay, well, I gotta take that a little bit more seriously. Then I saw it. It blew me away. Such a fantastic movie. I guess I'm not going to worry about spoilers here. But it was so entertaining that I always thought that I would love to see not only a sequel, but a prequel to this. Because I loved the crew inside that security company that was orchestrating the American sacrifices. I just loved Amy Acker, Bradley, Whitmore. Those guys were fantastic, and I wanted to see more of them. So I figured they should do a sequel where they have they show elements of the prequel, like something happening another year where the world doesn't end, but still some crazy stuff happens. And then they could also have some sequel elements where you could see gods walking the earth and decimating humanity. I mean, who doesn't want to see that stuff? So I just thought that would be a fantastic prequel-sequel type of duplicate.
Yeah, I disagree.
He's wrong.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a great movie. I agree that it was a fantastic movie. I love movies that deconstruct a genre, and did it in such a fantastic way. I love Kevin. Like, one of the monsters was Kevin, right? So it was just fantastic. But if you take a concept and then you execute it perfectly and it's completely done, why do it again? It's done. They did it.
Because that's why you want them to make The Golden Compass.
They didn't complete it.
Because they didn't execute it.
Well, there's room for improvement, but also they didn't complete it. This is done. I don't know why you would want to.
Because
do
we just want more of the monster scene where they come out of all the hatches.
But
and
they did it.
Awesome.
They did it.
I want to see it.
But don't forget, at the end of the movie, some serious stuff happened. I mean, ancient gods walking the earth and wiping out. Yeah, I want to see that. I like seeing that.
Did it leave enough Did it leave enough threads for it to continue into a second movie?
I think you could. I mean, it would be completely different, which kind of goes against what you're saying. Talk about not duplicating the first movie. That would by definition have to be quite different.
What about a prequel where they could show them? You know, so they're orchestrating this whole thing as
the American contingent of the.
All right, that's fine. But the prequel could be them, like, what happens over the, like, every year when this thing has to take place.
Steve wouldn't like to watch it. I would love to see it. I would like to see a series of, like the Japanese people. How do they do it? And the other countries, because there's lots of these things going. I just think there's plenty of stuff that can make entertaining hours of entertainment because the all concept right. is that good.
The other thing is, well, it'd be a good TV series, maybe, where they do every year. But you said like you want to see the end of the earth. Again, it's like to me that's like the end when they did the director's cut of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where you go on the ship. Yeah. And of course it was disappointing, right? You can't go on the alien ship because your imagination of what it's going to be like is always going to be better than whatever crack they show.
Well, sure, I understand what you're saying, but that's where the creativity and talent comes in. And yeah. we're assuming it's a great sequel. That's the premise. Yeah. So I'm very, assuming very it would have to be very good.
All right. Evan.
There's my movie.
Say what it is.
Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, 2003. Wonderful movie, one of my all-time favorite movies. Unlike perhaps some of the other movies, it definitely leaves itself open at the end for the movie series to have continued. French captain gets away, makes his escape.
Like Darth Vader escaping the Death Star.
Yeah. In a similar sort of way. the movie was certainly highly reviewed, did very well at the box office, won 2 Oscar awards. It would have won more. It was nominated in 10 categories. Would have won more if it wasn't for Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. That was the year it swept basically everything. I think this movie would have come away with much more accolades and honors. They got all the, obviously it's about, you know, seamanship and science. I mean, the science that they talk about in this movie is absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. Their whole trip, and they spend so much time at the Galapagos Islands, talk about naturalism and what they're thinking about. You know, did God design these things, or did they adapt on their own? And they have this whole question and series of back and forth conversation about that very thing. So it really had all the elements, I think, in what was a fantastic movie. And again, left itself open at the end that they definitely could have continued it. The book series, which I have not read, but it's 20 books about the two main characters, Captain Jack and the Dr. Stephen.
So it could be a franchise.
It could absolutely have been a franchise. I have no idea why they didn't try it again.
I mean, how did it do at the box office?
Yeah, it did very well at the box office. It did cost $150 million. To produce it, but it pulled in about $225 million worldwide. So
$150 million in 2003.
In 2003 dollars, that's expensive.
A lot.
That was a lot.
And they have the source material, so why wouldn't they make a sequel?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Yeah,
they should have.
So, guess what my movie was?
Any guesses?
Did you ever see Ernest Goes to Jail?
That wasn't it.
Wait, there is a scene though in that movie. Bob and I have this scene in Ernest Goes to Jail when he's looking in the mirror and he does all the accents in a row that I adore. I just watch it on YouTube all the time.
I remember watching that. It was just this goofy actor. I mean, I knew him from commercials and he played Ernest, that goofy character. And then he's in jail and he's riffing through these different impersonations. And I was like, damn, he's talented.
It turns out he was a Shakespearean actor.
I've seen him do Shakespeare. It was impressive as hell.
So I picked The Thing. I didn't like the prequel. I didn't like that they CG'd the effects that need to be practical.
The practical effects were better than the CG effects.
Yeah. It doesn't play well with that type of an effect. I mean, they spent a ton of money on it. They were kind of halfway practical, halfway CG. It just didn't look good.
Yeah.
The acting wasn't so good. I wasn't thrilled about the story.
It wasn't that horrible.
But to me,
go in with lower expectations. You'll be fine.
The next story that needs to be told is what happens after that night.
Yeah.
You know, when the last two characters die, you know, they're sitting there sweating.
Yes,
John Carpenter's.
John Carpenter's.
Yeah, I mean, the original one was, you know, it's kind of hokey.
What, the 50s one?
Yeah. But I just would like to see, like, the people that would respond to, hey, we're not getting in touch with our station, and then the...
Well, there would be two bases, the American one and then the Norwegian one would have gone down pretty much at the same time.
So then they would probably call the other station and say, hey, can your people go check on ours? Hey, we can't get in touch with our people.
Yeah, there's definitely a sequel in there. And that was a great, it's one of my favorite movies. It's a masterpiece from beginning to end.
It really is.
If you haven't seen it, you might think, oh, it's a horror movie, whatever, but it, just as a film, it's a great piece of work.
It didn't do well in the box office, unfortunately.
But it's a cult classic, and it really deserves it. Tom Carpenter did a really great job, John Carpenter. If you love this movie, I recommend, I have a podcast for you. There's a podcast, a short story that covers the thing. It covers this movie, but the entire like 30 or 40 minute narration is from their point of view of the alien. The entire movie's beat from beat.
It's really cool.
But it's from the alien's point of view, and it's a fascinating creative story. Okay. I recommend it. It's called The Things. Look it up.
There was a runner-up that we kind of all agreed should have had a sequel, and I don't know why it's
why
never had a
one?
Sequel.
What?
Was The Highlander. It was a great movie.
Why didn't they make a sequel?
There was never any sequel to it.
It's weird, too, because that movie was so good. Like, what happened?
I know. There's a lot of plot left open. But never, there was never a sequel to that
never
movie.
Never a sequel made for that movie.
All right.
Ever.
There's something
else. All right, let's flesh that out a little bit. We were expecting.
We don't have to explain the joke. They got it.
No, but there's backstory.
It's been a running joke for us for 30 years. Yeah. But they got the joke. Don't explain it. All right.
it's even funnier.
I know. So there's something else I noticed when I was in the UK, and that is there's never any paper towels in the bathroom.
With the exception
of the bathroom back there, which is funny. So I have this bit all ready to go. I haven't seen a single bathroom in the UK with paper towels.
Yes.
Yeah, the toilet, the restroom, the loo, the water closet. Yep.
Right.
The restroom, you guys call it a restroom. I took this picture myself in, I don't know, one of your grocery stores. And the sign caught my attention that says, what does it say? Every little bit counts. You know, we do this for the environment. I'm like, I wonder if that's actually true. So I did a little investigation. Before the show, I was talking to Jay's wife, Courtney, and I'm like, she's like, what are you going to talk about tonight, Steve? I'm going to talk about air dryers in the bathroom. And she was like, you what? She's not a little native since we've been here. So, you what? I said, trust me, it's going to be great. And then it was. But here we go. So... It is a very interesting story. You take any topic like this and you do a deep dive, and it's like this rabbit hole. It's amazing. So here's the thing. There's a few ways to evaluate what's a better option for drying your hands after you allegedly wash them in the bathroom. One is in the restroom. I'm going to say bathroom.
Working on it. We're working.
One is what's more energy efficient, right? What has a lower carbon footprint? What's better for the environment? Which one is cheaper, you know, for the people who are running the place? Which one is more sanitary? And which one is more desirable, you know, for the user, right? And then there's actually three options. There's not two options. There's the hot air dryers. There's paper towels.
And wiping your hands on your pants.
And
so there's four options.
There's four options. There's the J method. And then some people just don't dry their hands. They just shake their hands off and walk out without drying their hands. That's that option, which I don't recommend. And then there's the blade, like the Dyson thing, where it just shoots really fast stream of, it's not heated air, it's just room temperature air, but they shoot it, they basically physically blow the water off your hands, but they're not air drying your hands. So those are the three options. Of course, these are the hot air dryers. So the question is, are the hot air dryers better than the paper towels? What do you guys think?
Better in what way?
Well, any of those. So let's talk about energy efficiency. Which one has a lower carbon footprint? Paper towels or hot air dryers?
I would have guessed paper towels.
Yeah, paper towels, I'd say.
What do you guys think? So it's neither. They're about the same.
Okay.
And it depends on how you adjust the variable. So they basically overlap. The variables are like, well, how many pieces of paper are people using?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Two.
Well, two is like there's an average. You can take the average amount, but the method of dispensing them affects it, right?
You're right, because there's that crappy one where there's like a little line of paper, and your hands are wet, and you go up to pull it down.
And it always breaks.
And it rips out, and you get these two.
Right.
And then you got to flick those away.
Or the one where you have to do your hand in front of the infrared detector, and it never works because your hands are wet and cold. So you have to keep doing it.
And it reads it three times, three sheets of paper come out.
So yeah, or it could be a stack, and people are just going to grab it, right?
Yes.
So it depends on, and also, is it recycled? Is it recyclable? Right. How thick is the paper? What's your energy source? You know, if you're burning coal, to make your energy to run the hairdryer.
So Steve, what I do at work is, before I wash my hands, I do my hand over the infrared thing, and it comes out. Wash my hands, then I grab that, and then it's so tiny that it's not good enough. So then I walk over to the paper towel dispenser, throw that in, and grab one of those. So it's kind of like a two-part.
Got a whole system going.
Two-part thing.
And you grab the door handle, get all the germs back on your hands, and you start. You're no better off than where you started.
You got to like elbow out of the door. So basically, there's
if
so
it opens out,
there's no advantage to the air dryer over paper towel. You could easily make the paper towels better than the air dryer, depending on these variables, yeah. right? But they, but you, the air dryers could be better also. But the Dyson blades are much better than either of
they're
the other two.
For energy,
energy, for energy. Yes. They're very energy, because they're not heating the air. The heating the air is what uses all the electricity.
But Steve, real quick, don't forget, those air dryers suck.
I know.
I mean, it's a cliche. I mean, you stand there for like 20 seconds, dry your hands, and then it's like, then you walk away doing this. That's like everybody's done it.
It feels
everybody's
like a dog is panting on your hands when you use those, right?
It's terrible.
Well, it turns off automatically. You hit it again and again and again. It takes five times.
It's pathetic. So I would go with the paper towel then, all else being
equal. I personally prefer the paper towel just for comfort. But plus, what if you wash your face? I mean, what do you do with the air dryer?
Well, this one...
They sometimes turn upwards.
Yeah, this one, actually, the ones you took a picture of, if you push the bottom, it does blow the air up into your face.
And you want hot air blowing up into your nose?
No.
Yeah. So anyway, let's not get sidetracked with that. But that's the other point is how efficient is the blow dryer itself too, right? A good one, a new one, you know, it will be more energy efficient than an old one. But the air dryers, the blades are much more energy efficient. But let's flip now to hygiene.
Yes.
So there's two questions because, you know, this is blowing viruses and bacteria around, right? So the question is, are they blowing bacteria and viruses off your hands into the environment, and are they blowing bacteria and viruses from the environment onto your hands, mm-hmm. right? There's those two questions. And the answer is yes. They are doing both of those things
at the same time,
and the blades are like 1,000 times worse than the hot air dryer.
Why?
Because it's faster, right? So think it's just shooting your bacteria all over the bathroom.
Right. So those super accelerator ones, you know the ones that are like a jet engine?
Yeah, like, wah, yeah.
That's reaching every corner of the bathroom.
Right, right.
Whenever, yeah.
You know, so, but the studies, here's the problems with the studies. The studies aren't definitive for a couple of reasons. One is they're just looking at, they're just culturing bacteria from stuff. Your hands, the walls, and everything. They're not looking at the rate of getting sick, which would be a hard study to do, right? And they're... And the other thing is that a lot of the studies are funded by either the paper towel industry.
Big paper towel,
or the hot air manufacturer.
Big air dryer.
And they're like, they have these dueling studies, and they say, that study's crap. Look, we show these paper towels are all, you know, contaminated with bacteria. Like, no, their blades throw bacteria all over the place. So it's like these study wars going on in these industries. But there are independent studies as well, and you have to look at a lot of them to get a consensus. So kind of the consensus is, yeah, they blow bacteria around. I probably wouldn't have them in hospitals, you know. That's probably, any place like that is probably a bad idea.
Why can't they put a HEPA filter in the air?
You can. That's a good question. You put a filter in there, and it dramatically reduces the bacteria, but not completely.
Sure, but it's way better.
But it's way better. So you put, should, that's absolutely correct. You should put a filter in there. But here's the other thing. In terms of spreading bacteria from your hands to the environment, the most effective method is what?
Soap.
Just use soap, and it doesn't matter what you do. Because the soap gets rid of all the bacteria pretty much, and you're good. You can blow them, you can do whatever you want. So what's the lesson in all of this?
So you could blow them in the men's bathroom, is what you're saying.
Yeah. That's pretty much what I'm saying.
There was a wave of people that had that same thought. So like it when it's hot.
Yeah,
right.
They had the same thought, but they didn't say it on stage. You know, there are certain things you just keep.
That's my job, Bob.
All right.
What's the bottom line of all this? The bottom line is that plaque is probably crap. The details matter. The studies, they're kind of all over the place, and it depends on who does the study. But I think for the individual user, I think the bottom line is use soap. And that's probably the best thing that you can do. Try not to touch stuff in the bathroom and use soap. Either method is probably fine.
Steve, I really like your point about how... All right, the bottom line is, how many... Are you getting sicker by doing this?
Yeah, I couldn't find any data that...
To me, that's critical because you are... Your environment, this environment, is awash in bacteria. We all have our own bacterial clouds that follow us around. They're everywhere. So, there's a little bit more in the bathroom being flung on me. So what?
Yeah, it might
that,
be a
to
big
me,
so
it's
what?
Like big deal.
Right.
It's everywhere anyway.
Yeah, I do think it's like the paper industry trying to scare people away from the hot air blow dryers. I do think that's a lot of what's going on. And it may be meaningless. Although, like in hospitals where there's antibiotic-resistant bacteria everywhere, you probably might want to err on the side of not blowing that stuff all
over
the place.
Sure, I agree with that. Sure.
But in the bathroom, just wash your hands with soap. Just be have good hygiene. You know, don't wipe your eyes as soon as you leave the bathroom. Try to minimize that kind of exposure.
Is that good?
If you scrub into surgery, the physical mechanical scrubbing is 99% of the cleaning. So that's why I like to wipe my hands with paper towels, because that kind of physical washing of the hands is part of it. So you could do that with the soap. You could sort of rub your hands, and you get most of that effect as well. So again, what the studies show is if you wash your hands well with soap, that's as good as you're going to do.
So have you done that thing where you wash your hands as a doctor and you walk around? And then if people come near you, you yell at them, "I'm sterile."
I never had to do that because that's a very TV thing, but
that's a trope. Yeah, that's a trope. That's a myth.
Yeah, don't touch me. I'm sterile.
I always wanted to do that. Yeah,
because you go right from there into the OR. Like, there's no place for that to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right.
I love it.
Yeah, that's why they do it. All right. The next segment. So we wanted to talk about some classic pseudosciences, partly because. We've been reading a lot about what young people believe, and it turns out that while they're turning away from a lot of institutional or organized religion, belief in things like astrology and spiritualism and New Age beliefs are actually on the rise among the millennials, and which is things that we've been saying for 30 years. Like, yeah, things come and go. They never go away completely. If you follow belief in UFOs over the last 100 years, it does it does a sine wave of about every 20 years. It peaks, then it goes away for a while, then it comes back. Every generation basically has to go through the process for themselves of thinking, oh, this is interesting, and then 20 years goes by and there's no aliens. Like, oh, that's boring, right? And then they forget about it, but then it comes back to the next generation. So all the things that we thought we dealt with in the 90s are starting to come back now. In whatever you call these. Right, they're not the aughts, they're the teens, I guess, the 20-teens. So we want to make sure that, and the skeptics, we are the keepers of the flame, right? We're the ones...
Vanguard.
The guardians of forever. So we're the ones...
We need costumes for this.
I know.
No,
don't get me started.
And capes.
No capes!
And no capes.
But what we do need to do, in all seriousness, is we are the ones who remember that UFOs are bullshit, right? And why, in detail, so that when the new generation's like, oh, but what about this? We're like, okay, we got that covered,
We actually say, man, we've been waiting for you for 20 years.
Right? No, it's like the immune system, right? You have that anamnestic response, as we call it. We're the vaccine, right? Yeah. So that we get a much more robust, rapid response to the bullshit because we've already debunked it, right? So we're going to do that right now. So Bob's going to start us off with a discussion of a good classic pseudoscience, ESP.
Take it away, Bob.
ESP. This one is a little poignant for me because I wrote an article about ESP. It was a huge article for our New England Journal of Skepticism. And I was looking through it in the past couple of days, just kind of refreshed my memory. And I looked at the date. It was October 1998. So I'm going to do some math here. That's 20 years ago to this month, maybe even this week, that I wrote it. So it's just kind of interesting that I'm talking about it again. So ESP, extrasensory perception, this is something that's really, it's such an iconic paranormal belief. We believed in a lot of this stuff when we were growing up. It's just so compelling. The main components, telepathy, precognition, and clairvoyance. It's the idea that the human mind can forge a connection and exchange information with another mind, from the future or from an object. And this is still, I think, a lot of people just have this baseline belief. Even if you're a little bit skeptical, I think ESP, there's still some hope that ESP is going, they're going to find something that's real about it. And you can still, they're still doing studies to this day. I looked into the history of ESP, found a couple interesting things. 1870, the term extrasensory perception is alleged to have been coined by, see if you guys know this person, the British explorer Sir Richard Burton. Does that ring a bell? He's alleged to have come up with this term. 1882, the word telepathy was formally used for the first time by the Society of Psychical Research in Britain, again.
So they believed it.
Oh, yeah. This is the birth. Remember, this is ESP was really just coming along at this point. And it's interesting to find out when telepathy was kind of born itself. And then in the 1930s was another milestone. Decades later, J.B. Ryan, that's kind of a well-known name.
Right.
He's the one that kind of was the first to use the initialism ESP and connect it to telepathy and clairvoyance and things like that. He also was the first person to come up with what is called today ESP cards. What were they called back then? Nobody.
I know.
Of course you know.
Damn it.
What were they called back then in the for decades?
Zener cards, yeah.
Zener, Zener.
Zener, Zener.
So following that, there were decades of apparently successful experiments with ESP. They were all over the place. They actually did a meta-analysis. They did a meta-analysis in 1940, going back to the 1880s. They went through all the research for ESP, and they claimed a 60% success rate.
Whoa. But that's interesting. The 60% figure keeps cropping up, right?
That's over and over.
Whenever you're talking about basically preliminary or not rigorous research where there's probably no real effect there, the false positive effect size always seems to land on 60%.
So you're saying that got into the culture and could never be scrubbed out?
No, I'm just saying that. That's when you do p-hacking and you're faking, not faking, yeah. When you're using bad methodology but you're looking for something that doesn't exist, it always seems like they're able to cheat their way up to 60%.
I see.
Right?
Yeah, there were obviously lots of problems. If you're coming up with any statistically significant incidence of ESP, we all know there's probably a problem with your experiment. There was lots of things where they would pick the specific results. There would be optional starting and stopping, just flat out bad statistics. And whenever they would tighten the controls, of course, all of that would vanish. And the tighter the controls got, any of the interesting results went to zero.
Yeah. And they actually call that the decline effect.
The decline effect, which is classic because it's like, of course, as the skeptics get closer, the effect kind of disappears. It's just so ridiculous.
As is true with many things we talk right. about.
So, but the thing that really, that I thought 20 years ago and still today, that you don't see very much of or not enough of is a debunking of ESP in terms of what does science actually have to say about ESP. What would it take for the mind to have telepathy or clairvoyance or anything like that? What would actually be happening? So you'd have to look at the fundamental forces of nature, right? I mean, that's a great
Good
place to start because these are the forces that scientists have determined exist and do work, and they are really real. So if you look at nuclear forces like the strong force, which holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom, incredibly strong, amazingly strong. The weak force, which is responsible for some types of radioactivity, beta decay. The problem with those forces is, as strong as they are, incredibly short-acting. They only work within, say, femtometers, which is something like 1/10,000,000th of the diameter of a human hair. I mean, this is tiny, tiny. I mean, what am I going to put my head right next to Jay and try to...
Wouldn't get to the skull. So they're out.
But Bob, right. If it worked, we'd do that. You know what I mean?
Sure. But nobody's claiming that. I banged my head into Jay and I was able to read his mind. So that clearly such a short-acting force isn't going to do it. Then gravity is another possibility. Now, gravity is not short-acting. Gravity extends throughout the known universe. So clearly that could potentially have an effect, right? Because distance really doesn't matter. And that's because gravity is additive. There's no charge, so this just keeps piling up and actually orchestrates the structure of the large-scale universe. It's amazing what it can do. The problem is that gravity is amazingly weak. It's the weakest force by far. But the other problem with gravity is that gravity doesn't care about the structure of the brain or what you're thinking.
Gravity don't care.
Gravity don't care. It's all about mass and density. So if I had a lump of coal that had the same mass and density of my brain, it would pretty much have the same gravitational field. So that's clearly not an option.
Plausible.
The other option now, electromagnetism. Now, on the surface, that one actually
that seems
looks,
like it's the one.
It
right?
seems plausible because it's long acting. It could travel. I mean, the photons will travel. Electromagnetic radiation will travel forever until it's absorbed by something.
And we use it to do data transmission.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So basically, if you had a radio transmitter and receiver in your head, that would be the force that would be at work. But we don't have radio.
Yeah. But wait a second. Right. Because you see, you always want to equate it to, like, what's the physics? This is a metaphysical...
What's wrong with that, Jay?
No, but what I'm saying is, this is magic. This is...
Well, yeah, but Bob is correct, though. We want to say, is it plausible based upon known physics? Yeah. So that's perfectly reasonable line of argument.
Right, so let's knock down electromagnetism. First off, there's the inverse square law. Yeah. If a light source is twice the distance, the intensity is only 25%. So nobody... Now, if they show that effect with ESP, like, hey, I could read his mind at this distance, but it was really faint when I went twice as far away, nobody has ever said that,
And they've looked for it.
They've looked for the decline effect,
so they've designed experiments.
Yeah, they've designed experiments to see, does the effect get weaker with distance? And they've also tried to shield it, and you can't shield the effect. So that pretty much right there disproves
electromagnetism.
Did they
try tinfoil, though? I mean,
yeah, they did. They tried basically the equivalent of tinfoil to shield your head.
Imagine?
No, that's...
I would totally shape the tinfoil into just a big penis.
Yeah. Or you could wear the Magneto helmet.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
That would actually work. Magneto wore the helmet to guard himself against Professor Xavier. Right. That would work.
But there's even other problems. There would be, you would have electrical interference because of all the electrical devices that are ubiquitous in our environment. Also, your skull filters out electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
Anything that could possibly get out would then be further attenuated trying to get into somebody else's skull. That's really does
well,
not make any sense.
How do you explain people that have braces picking up radio stations then?
That just destroys my argument, Jay. So the other thing that's very interesting that people don't often mention is that we are masters of electromagnetism. Yeah. Think about the accomplishments in the past 100 years. We can detect and manipulate electromagnetic radiation from gamma rays to radio waves. We can detect with the subtlest nuance so many things about it. And
we would not miss this,
and this would be some radiation that could cause some neurochemical change in the brain so that you could read somebody's mind. This is something that would not be missed. This is something that would, your great-grandfather could have detected something like that.
So they have to argue that there is an unknown force.
Right.
They'd have to go there, or something really esoteric, like, say, of course, quantum mechanics. They got to jump into quantum mechanics.
Axions.
Or entanglement's good, because entanglement seems to transfer information very long distances.
But it doesn't.
But it doesn't, because it's not information. It's just random. It's random data.
They don't have to explain a goddamn thing if the shit worked. I don't care what the answer is, but if you can communicate to someone in another room or halfway across the world and it's like, you know, the testing is coming out like, holy crap, this is really working. Okay, you got me. I'll believe
it. Right. So that's true. So experiments have failed and physics has failed. There's one other way to look at this, and that is biology, receptors, the five senses. What do you got? Sight.
There's more than five, touch. But yeah.
The five classic ones. But there's also, there's receptors for each of those classic senses. But there's like, I think there's actually nine receptors for senses that are much more subtle that people don't really think about, like proprioception, the orientation of your limbs. There are actual receptors in your body to detect these things.
Detecting a fart against poop, like, you know. It's true!
Are you sure we won
She's
this
laughing.
Award?
This is real. This is science. I read it like 6 months ago.
Yeah, it's our name.
We have the ability, your butt can tell if it's gas or if it's solid.
Imagine if you couldn't.
That's when you get old. You
excellent.
Get
old. Excellent point, Jay. So my point before we started talking about farts was that there's no like mysterious receptors in people. Like, wait, this is a receptor. I've never seen that before. It's never been described by science. What's it doing?
Right, yeah.
That's the kind of thing that's kind of, it's conspicuous in its absence that there is no receptor for this type of stuff. So
none of this proves that ESP doesn't work because we're discovering new stuff about the body still. Some receptor could have gotten under the wire. I'll buy that. A new force, I don't buy that. Because, there would be something that operating in the world that like that we would have detected the effects of it by now. It's really hard for us to miss something that's operating on human scales, you know? So that's really, really unlikely. So, if you had, all that tells me is that it doesn't prove it doesn't work. It means that the probability is extremely low.
Right.
When you have extremely low probability, you need really good evidence.
Of course.
And what we have is really low probability and really crappy evidence, which is a pattern that we see over and over again. That's the pattern of pseudoscience, of stuff that doesn't exist.
Right.
That pattern's very kind. The decline effect always declines to zero.
Yeah, but tell that to Dean Radin. Tell that to Alex Securus. Tell it to the whole host
Darryl
of people
Ben.
Out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Yep. Who just are making a living on this stuff.
Right. Well, I have.
I told know them to that.
They're not buying it. But that's the difference between, and ESP is the one, like when I encounter people like, ESP is real, the evidence shows it, you're being a denier, of the ESP evidence. So why do they believe and why do I not believe? And that, that's where the rubber meets the road, right? That's because they think, they are compelled by crappy evidence.
Yep.
And they don't know it's crappy because they're just not sophisticated enough
they
in their
interpretation. They don't know how to determine what's good. Yeah.
And another quick angle is, if this were true,
we'll get there.
The evidence would be in our face. People would be using this ability. Come on, a superpower.
And the other thing I like to say is
they'd be flaunting that all over.
You make the special pleading about the effect, whatever. It doesn't affect this, or it's only when the skeptics aren't there, and it's really small. It's really small. At some point, the difference between a super tiny effect that you can't really prove with experiments and no effect at all becomes insignificant.
Yeah.
Right. So we're there. We are more than there. All right, Evan.
Yep.
Tell us about Nessie.
Nessie, the creature that lives in the Loch Ness, right in the Scottish Highlands, which we visited.
That's
Loch Ness. No,
We went to Loch Lomond.
Yeah.
No monster there. Didn't make it up.
We looked.
Our tour guide said, you don't want to go to Loch Ness. It's boring. It's a tourist trap.
It's for the rubes.
She said she liked that we didn't even ask about it.
Yeah. Right? We knew better. Yeah, cool. She did. She was very...
She had no idea who was on her bus.
Yeah. Often described as large in size, a long neck, and one or more humps, although you can't really see it here in this particular...
I always thought that picture looked like a hand, right? Isn't it like this... It's not, but I always thought it looked like that.
I always thought it looked like an elephant's trunk.
Okay, so this... Yeah, a little bit. It could be anything. No, I can't do that.
I thought it looked like a plesiosaur.
The supposed size of this creature varies. Some have it described as small as 6 meters. Others have it described as 17 meters. There's a wide variety of
sizes. Babies and adults.
Apparently so. You'd think there'd be a thriving population of them by those accounts. But the evidence of its existence is entirely 100% anecdotal. There is no evidence, no scientific evidence that proves the existence of it. Okay, so why does it persist? And it does persist.
Tourism?
Tourism's one of the main reasons, and I'll use the phrase unsinkable rubber duck in a certain way. It just gets out in the culture, and there's no way to knock it down. I did a cursory search today on Google in 2018 alone, found 6 articles about scientific investigations that are occurring between real scientists and enthusiasts and cryptozoologists and everyone at the Loch this year conducting all sorts of experiments. So it is as popular now as I think it probably ever was. So Nessie's the champion of the cryptozoological world. People's fascination with this creature apparently has no boundaries. 200,000 searches on Google per month for the Loch Ness Monster. Yes, okay. And it all really started in its popularity growth, much like Bob was talking about when the Big Bang of ESP happened. You got to go back to the year 1933. He was a Londoner, Mr. George Spicer. Congratulations, London. He and his wife were driving around the Loch, and they saw, I quote, "the nearest approach to a dragon or prehistoric animal that I'd ever seen in my life, trundling across the road towards the Loch with an animal in its mouth." And that report caught the papers, and after that, you had all sorts of people giving all sorts of testimony that they saw a monster, and oh my gosh. And by 1934, the famous surgeon's photo, which we see right here, Loch Ness monster hysteria was underway.
Now, people were flocking to the Loch?
The Loch flock, yeah. That's right. You can generally break down the sightings or the explanations for these sightings, I think, into kind of 3 distinct categories. So we'll go with the first one. The possibility to explain the sightings could be deliberate hoaxes, okay, which is kind of why I have this particular picture first up here. We already know for a fact that has happened throughout the decades. Tons and tons of hoaxes, but this is probably the most famous one because the photograph itself and then, of course, the revelation in the 1990s that they came forward. A couple of the people were still alive who perpetrated this hoax and were in on it, and they admitted that it was. So here's the backstory, though. Supposedly, this photo was taken by Robert Kenneth Wilson, who was also from London. Congratulations, London. Here we go. Published in the Daily Mail on the 21st of April, 1934. He refused to have his name associated with it, though, so it became known as the surgeon's photograph, because he was a doctor. Yeah. He was, in fact, a doctor. And according to Wilson, he was looking at the Loch when he saw the monster. He grabbed his camera and snapped 4 photos. Only 2 of the exposures came out clearly. Really, 1 that wasn't blurry, and this is it.
That's the not blurry one?
Yep, that is it. There are several problems with this particular photo. First of all, the overall lack of perspective. That is always a red flag when you have photographic evidence. I mean, if I throw something into a clear blue sky and take a photo of it, you have absolutely no idea how close, far away it is, or exactly even what it is. When you have a similar photo like this, you could float something out on the water. You have no idea the size of that.
Sure.
Unless you're an expert in certain things, such as water and waves.
Yeah.
And they did, and the experts have looked at the ripples in this pond, and they have determined that based on the pattern of ripples, unlike large waves photographed up close, the analysis shows that this is about 60 to 90 centimeters long, or 2 to 3 feet.
Wow.
That was a pretty darn good guess, because that's actually what
did happen. Didn't do a damn thing, though, right?
No, And then, of course, it was exposed as a hoax. And it was actually first reported as a hoax in 1975, ran in the paper, and nobody paid any attention to it, essentially. It went under the radar. His name was Marmaduke Weatherall. He was one of the three or four people involved in this hoax, and he gave an interview to the paper basically saying, yeah, we put this thing together.
He admitted
to the hoax. And he had a history of doing hoaxes.
Did they not believe him because his name was Marmaduke?
Probably. It's tough to trust anyone named that.
But what struck me about this photo, just if I may,
yep.
this is like the photo of every cryptozoological creature or ghost or UFO or whatever that we've ever seen, right? It's at that perfect distance and resolution and quality, so it's suggestive, but it doesn't really tell you anything. You can't definitively identify it. So yeah, it's just enough to be mystery mongering.
What it is, it's a toy submarine about 2.5 feet long, and they spent some time, the hoaxers did, building it up with some wood and putty and constructing it over the course of a couple days. They sent it out there, they shot the photographs, the thing sunk, they were not able to recover it, legend has it, that this is still in the lock somewhere. That would be quite fine. You know what that would be worth? Oh my gosh.
But those locks,
I bet you someone would pay £1 million for
that. Ev, those locks are super deep.
They can be. But where they floated it out there, I don't think was actually all that deep. Probably wasn't. Yeah, they just admitted, in fact, one of them, who was 93 years old and on his deathbed, but he was more than happy to talk about his role in this particular hoax.
That's not the only Loch monster.
No. Well, actually, it's not. But I do want to, before we get off the Loch Ness, per se, if we can go to the next slide, because there, the second possibility, I'm talking about these three different possibilities of what the Loch Ness monster really could be, or cryptozoological things in general. And what possibly can explain some of these sightings is honest misinterpretations.
Yeah. Pareidolia.
So you see this picture of the Loch Ness Monster, how blurry it is, right? Has anyone seen this picture before? This is considered to be the first photograph taken of the supposed monster in 1933. Anyone see a dog holding a stick in its mouth? Can you make out a Labrador sort of to the left of the stick? That's what it is. They didn't know what they had until after it was developed. Did not among the who knows how many photographs that this particular person took that day, and decided, oh my gosh, I caught something here. I have no idea what it is. That's a genuine misinterpretation. Yep. So that's another set of explanation that you can talk about when it comes to these sorts
of
things.
That's the blob squatch.
Right, blob squatch is essentially what we like to call that. And then the third possible explanation for the sightings, what you could do is also take the premise that, okay, let's say it does exist. All right, let's say this creature does exist. From a practical standpoint, how is it existing? What is its food source? Yeah. Where are the cadavers of these things when they die?
Right.
How is the population procreating? How many do you need to sustain a population?
Genetically sustainable population is about 2,000.
2,000 of these things. No, zero, nada.
Right.
Zero evidence for any of this. Not a fragment of a single bone of one of these creatures.
And now they've scanned the lock. They've tested it for DNA. I mean, they've done all these analyses.
Laser analysis. Yeah. I mean, right up through this year, and they continue to look for it. Just amazing. Just amazing.
Now, the answer we always get when we talk about things like this is, well, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, well, yes, it is. It may not prove definitively a negative, because you can't, but it is evidence. And the more we pile up evidence of a lack of something, the more confident we are in the conclusion that something is not there. Right now we are so past a confidence level that there's not a giant plesiosaur or whatever swimming around Loch Ness, so that we can conclude, there's probably not one there. All right.
Here we go.
So we went to the Natural History Museum, which we always love Natural History Museums. So the one in D.C., the one in New York. Now I've been to the one in London, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, the museum was
epic. It was like we had like 2 hours there or something. I was like, I want to spend 2 days here.
It
was just so much to see. But the one thing I wanted to see the most was not on display.
Yeah.
And those were the Piltdown specimens. So, again, this is the Piltdown Man is perhaps the most famous scientific hoax. These fossils were found in 1912 by Charles Dawson. Now, Charles Dawson was a amateur fossil collector. He actually collected a lot of genuine specimens that now are in the Natural History Museum. So he made a career. I mean, he had a day job, but basically on the side, he was actually a reasonably skilled archaeologist, fossil collector, and contributed a lot of specimens. And he wanted to be famous, but he never quite got up to the level of fame that he was looking for. And shortly after his brother was knighted, some people think this is relevant, he discovered these fossil remains of what appeared to be a very human-like skull with a very ape-like jaw. And he showed it to his friend and colleague, Arthur Smith Woodward, and the two of them analyzed it, and he was the scientist, Woodward, and published it as a paper in 1913 and 14, in two papers. The other sort of background going on here, at the same time, in 1908, Homo heidelbergensis was discovered in Germany, and the English were very jealous that Germany had an early man. And it kind of implied that man evolved in Germany, because at the time we didn't have any African specimens. And of course, so the Europeans were like, yeah, of course, man evolved in Europe, but not in Germany, right? They wanted to find a good, English specimen. They wanted to have priority. It reminds me of the N-ray story, which we go over in our book, the N-ray story, where the Germans discovered X-rays and the French were like, we have to discover our own rays. So they discovered N-rays, which turned out not to be true. So this is the British version of the N-rays, where the Germans discovered Heidelbergensis and then they discover Piltdown Man. So the British archaeological community was like, this is fantastic. This is exactly what we were looking for, right? So it's what they expected to find. Because the belief at the time...
That's critical. This is critical.
The belief at the time was that... Because, we had very few specimens. We had some Homo neanderthalensis and Heidelbergensis, and we're just getting some really early humans. The thinking was that probably what happened was that the brain evolved first and then guided the evolution of the body, right? So the body evolved to match the intelligence of the brain. So they were expecting to see large-brained but primitive-bodied human ancestors.
Top down. When you make that kind of prediction and it comes true... I mean, that is gold.
But that's when you need to be most suspicious, right? Of course, the reality is the exact opposite, is that our evolutionary path happened to go create, like Homo erectus is probably the best example, like fully human bodies with a small brain, right? But the idea of like an ape-like brain and a human body was just disturbing to them.
So then when they did find the real skulls, though, they were like, whoa, what's going on here? This doesn't fit.
So... There was a double whammy. It met their predictions, and it was in England, right? So it was in the UK, so that was fantastic. So this was, very enthusiastically accepted by the scientific community. But not everybody, right? So there was some early skepticism. For example, the jaw and the skull fragments don't have the parts that make them join together, right? So the fragments that were found didn't have the matching pieces.
How convenient.
Yeah, how convenient. And someone said, well, how do you know you didn't find, because there were other, animal bones in there. How do you know you didn't just find, ape bones and human bones in the same place? So then there was Piltdown 2. So a year or two later.
This time it's personal.
Piltdown 2. Right? Dawson comes and says, oh, look, I found another tooth and another and some more other skull fragments. So now that's a second find with jaw and skull fragments together, and it was a canine, and there were some details about the canine. So essentially, the exact specimens that answered the skepticism of Piltdown 1 were found in Piltdown 2. Like, it was like made, designed to shut up the critics, and it worked. Mm-hmm. Because the interesting thing is it worked, it shut them up. And for 40 years... This was accepted by the scientific community.
That's incredible.
For 40 years. But what happened over that time is that we were discovering more and more fossils, right? And they were, Piltdown Man was being shoved increasingly to a side branch because it was fitting less and less with all the other fossils we were finding until someone said, wait a minute, let's take another look at these fossils. Because here's the other thing. This is another mistake that the scientific community made.
Yep.
They made casts of the fossils, and they gave the casts to all the other scientists, but the originals were then locked away in a vault. So no one got to see the originals. They were only looking at casts of the originals. And so in 1953, Kenneth Oakley of the Natural History Museum here in London said, I want to take a look at those original fossils and re-examine them. And he did. And he discovered that they were faked, right? That they were not that old, right? They were not. They couldn't be more than a few hundred years old. They weren't hundreds of thousands of years old.
Don't you wish somebody had an iPhone back then and recorded his reaction? Oh, yeah, like, yeah. Holy crap!
And they were stained to match the rubble that they were found in.
And that staining is important because that staining could have been discovered decades prior to that.
Yeah. But at the time,
they were so motivated to believe it, they didn't even think about it.
There's been recent re-examination just a couple of years ago of the fossils.
And now it's real.
No. So they wanted to know, because now we could do DNA analysis.
Sure.
You know, we could do all kinds of things they couldn't do at the time. And some interesting tidbits came out.
It's his brother, the one that won the Nobel Prize?
No. So the specimens came from one orangutan specimen and two or more human specimens. So there was at least two pieces that were not the same person. And they were able to date them more accurately. Again, it was just the orang was probably a couple hundred years old. The humans were contemporary. They were like in the 19th century specimens. Mm-hmm. So, and the techniques that were used to prepare them were very amateurish. So it kind of fit Dawson because he was not a professional. He was an amateur collector. So he like did bad technique.
Yeah, didn't he use a barbecue rub on the bones?
Yeah. No, I mean, he basically just rubbed them down with this iron, I think, based stain. So they basically proved the consensus now. For a long time, it was a mystery who did it, but now it pretty much had to be Dawson, and he probably was acting alone. I mean, it's hard to prove that nobody else knew about it, but he was everywhere that they were found. He was the only one who found the second ones. Mm-hmm. He never even told them where he found them. Like, there's no site for Piltdown II. He's just like, here, I got some extra bones for you.
Yeah, the
you
site know? Was his garage.
Yeah, right. Basically. Does wow. anybody here know what you guys probably know this? The oldest complete human skeleton found in Great Britain. Cheddar Man. You guys hear Cheddar Man?
Cheddar Man?
Cheddar Man.
Cheddar Man. Recently, this is 1903, it was discovered, 10,000 years old. Recent DNA analysis showed that he was blue-eyed and dark-skinned. So the first Britons were very, very dark-skinned. They didn't know that before him. But there are the oldest evidence for human ancestors being in Great Britain goes back about 950 to 700,000 years, but that evidence is only tools. We don't have the bones to go with them, so we don't know the species. It was probably Homo antecessor, which is just a very early human ancestor. The first fossils are Heidelbergensis as well, 500,000 years ago. And then interesting, because Great Britain's an island, right? And it's not, you can't just walk across, except you can when the climate is at, when the seas drop enough, like during glacial periods, right? So during glacial periods, you could walk to Great Britain, and then interglacial periods, you can't. So there were multiple waves of humans, about 10 separate waves of humans coming to Great Britain, and they all died out, except 12,000 years ago. So 12,000 years ago is when there was the continuous presence of people in Great Britain. So there's a little bit of the history of people in Great Britain. But yeah, Piltdown Man, there's so many lessons from this story. It is a classic. We can't forget it because we can't forget those lessons. And the biggest of which is when you find exactly what you're looking for, need to be the most skeptical, right? All right, Jay, the last classic pseudoscience we're going to cover is UFOs.
So the UFO mythology is awesome because almost every story about UFOs, they all kind of rummage around the same things. They pull out all the same tropes. So I just picked one that I thought you guys would be familiar with, the Rendlesham Forest. You guys know about this? It's kind of like our Area 52.
51.
51, whatever.
51, 52, whatever it takes.
I thought Area 52 was cooler.
No, it's the UK Roswell.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, the brief summary on the story, I'm sure you know it, is that there's military base, Air Force bases near the forest. One of the bases said, hey, we see some lights. So they send out some people. They go take a look. Then they're seeing light through the trees, and they think that they see some type of craft. They come back with a story that they're seeing, metal lights on there, their tree branches were broken, stuff like that. And this thing, very quickly, over the few days that this all occurred, it went from seeing lights to they see imprints in the ground of the ship when it landed.
Well, they saw imprints in the ground.
Yeah, they saw
it. Which they interpreted as the ship.
That's right. Yeah, there were imprints there.
What else could it
have been? Of course. Part of the thing is, you had these Air Force people that are, one of them was quite famous, and he wrote, he had this memo, the big memo that he was keeping track of. Now, this is someone that has a career in the military,
which should be respected. This is someone that's involved with the Air Force, which is like, hey, these Air Force people, they get things in the air. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like anything that comes from outer space, whatever. It gives them some added gravitas. You know, it turns out that these people that claim to see all this stuff, it was all made up, or they were confused. Yeah, and the ones that don't understand how easily we can be fooled, right? How many times do we have to hammer that idea into everyone's heads? But it's true. You know, we're so easily fooled by our own, you know, our brain is trying to make sense of reality. We all have our own versions of reality. You know, you go back to, like, the stories of a car accident, and the cops show up, and 10 minutes later, people are being interviewed. What happened? You get all these different stories. How's that happen? Well, because everyone's massive filters that are happening in everyone's brain. And, you know, and like we've said before, you see things that you want to see. Mm-hmm.
Or that you expect to see. Or you don't know what you saw, and your memory gets contaminated by talking about it with the other guy,
exactly.
And you build a story together.
That happens a lot.
So what my favorite part of this particular story, there was a couple of things. You know, one, they went back. They doubled down. They found more evidence. The tree branches. The animals were going crazy that night. You know, they were saying all these animals were freaking out, going into a frenzy that night for unexplained reasons, Evan. You know, I love doing this. Now, you're the alien. And you're like, we're going to land. No, we're not. We're going to pull it back. Right, shine a light now. Get the light in the wood. Right there. Over there. Okay, good. They're over there. Shine a light over there. Now, make the animals go nuts. Awesome.
Break some branches.
It's so stupid when you just look at it from these other intelligent perspective. It's like, okay, the aliens are after
them. Going to mess with those monkeys on the planet.
In 1997, a Scottish researcher named James Easton, he got his hands on the original witness statements from the night of the 26th. Now, check this out. One witness said, his name was Ed Cabinsag, he said, "We figured the lights were coming from past the forest since nothing was visible when we passed through the woody forest. We would see a glowing near the beacon light." He's talking about, the lighthouse. That's right over there, 2 miles over there.
The alien lighthouse.
But we got closer, and it was a lit-up farmhouse. And we got the vantage point where we could determine that what we were chasing was only a beacon light off in the distance. So this is just one of the people that was there saying, you know, we found a farmhouse, there was lights there. There was a beacon light off in the distance, the lighthouse. You know, he's not jumping to insane conclusions. The next person that he was looking into the history of his statement said, "We could see a beacon going around, so we went towards it. We followed it for about 2 miles, 3 kilometers, before we could see it was coming from the lighthouse." So there just so happens to be a farmhouse there. There just so happens to be a lighthouse there that could produce that intensity of the light.
And on the 1 or 2 days a year when there's no fog, they could see it.
Exactly. And that was the weird anomaly that night. Okay. It was a fogless night and they could see the lights. The other thing is, you know, they looked into the animal noises. The deer. There was deer in the woods.
Yeah.
Those deer make weird animal noises at night. You know, they're having sex at night and they're screaming in delight. And they run away when they see people coming with flashlights.
Wouldn't you?
Yes, I've done that. So the 3 points. Maybe, you know, now that I'm 50, I wouldn't run away. You want it? It's right here. Go for it. Okay. The most widely accepted explanations in those sightings were due to a combination of 3 factors. So the first one is the initial sightings that were at 3 a.m. The airmen saw something apparently descending into the forest, and it coincided with the appearance of a bright fireball over South England. And these fireballs are a common source of UFO reports. So it could have been, you know, a meteorite. It could have been anything that would produce that kind of light. That's one thing. Next thing is the supposed landing marks were identified by police and foresters as rabbit diggings. Mm-hmm. These were not alien metal feet touching the ground and leaving this awesome imprint that we all would like to see. It just happened to be like, the foresters like, that's what they're saying is a spaceship. That's rabbits do that. Right. It's all over the place.
But airline pilots don't know that.
Of course. Yeah, they don't know about rabbits.
They know about rabbits, right.
And according to witness statements from the 26th of December, the flashing light seen from the forest lay in the same direction, as the lighthouse.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could explain a lot of the things that they're seeing. You know, branches were broken. I don't know what the reason was for that, but, you know.
Branches get broken.
Yeah, wind, tree branches come down.
So the hype is correct. It's just as dumb as Roswell.
That's right.
Yeah. When you dig down, it always is like it's incredible. Before we go on to the last segment, I have a question for you guys.
Yes.
Do you guys want to meet the fourth Novella brother?
Yeah.
Joe! Grab the microphone. All right, so did that, I don't know if anybody knew that there was a fourth novella brother.
Not only a fourth novella brother, but he's my dizygotic fraternal twin.
Right. Twins!
Joe.
We call Joe the backup.
The backup rogue or the other brother?
The other brother
is what I hear.
I like that one. We got to get button eyes on you.
Thank you for the invite. It's my first time on a regular show.
Yeah.
I've been on some irregular shows.
I've been on a couple of our videos.
You obviously want to impress your London crowd.
So. You brought out our big guns.
Yeah. Clearly.
I'm happy to back you guys up.
Thanks, Joe.
It's time for science or fiction.
So, Joe, we're going to bring you on for science or fiction.
Okay.
You've never played science or fiction before.
No.
Let me tell you the rules.
I play it in my car every week when I'm listening.
Yeah, so you know the rules.
And I win every week.
Awesome.
So every week we come up with two science news items, or three science news items. In fact, two are real. I got it. And one's fake. Don't worry.
I made a nervous.
10 events in 10 days. And one of them is fake. Right? So,
okay.
And because I didn't have time to do it again until I did it last night, Jay's doing tonight. Jay, you haven't done one in a while, so this better be good.
I'm doing a special London edition.
Yes.
So I thought it would be fun to talk about laws in the UK or in London, right? I'm sure that this applies probably to the whole UK, but I was trying to focus on London.
No. Scotland has different laws.
Yeah, but a lot
of these might be English laws.
Yes, they could be very old too.
I'm clarifying. I'm skeptical.
You're being skeptical.
Okay.
You go, Joe. You tell them.
So here's the deal: these laws either once were true or are currently true.
They may still be on the books.
Right. Except one of them is a complete fake.
Right. It's not fake only because it's no longer on the books. It was never on the books.
Right. The fake is completely made up, and I checked.
Okay.
All right. So there's double points here, guys. Win science or fiction. Whoa. By picking the correct one. But you could also, at the end, you could tell me which ones you think are still active versus inactive laws.
What
okay?
do we get for double points?
All right. We'll talk about that later. You get to buy me dinner because I'm hungry. All right. Ready. The first one is, men in England are required to practice their archery every Sunday.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The second one is, it is illegal for milkmen to only knock once.
But the postman can ring twice.
Number three, it is illegal to cause a nuclear explosion. Number four, it is illegal to handle salmon under suspicious circumstances. And you should see the ones I didn't pick. What the hell? It's like some crazy laws, guys. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We are not asking you guys. We're going to ask you at the end. I'm going to go through.
Why, because you think they know the answer?
It's possible.
Okay.
No?
No, that's too good. Right. Let's start with Joe.
All right. So, Joe, you have to answer this question. Which one of these is fake?
One is totally made up.
One is completely made up. The other ones were at one point or currently are legitimate
one.
Laws. All right. So, Joe
wait,
says.
Wait. Don't I get to pontificate? You
yes.
guys pontificate like crazy.
You said one.
No. I was just kidding.
All right. Go ahead.
All right, Joe.
Wait, this is my chance. I think one is possibly, maybe one, because Sunday is a holy day. You're not supposed to do anything, but, yeah. Right? So that leads me to think that might be, have never been on the books. Milkman knocking once, that would be impolite not to knock more than once and not get your milk. That would be crazy. I truly believe that it would be illegal to not have a nuclear explosion. That would be a good law to have. If you're regulating arms and the manufacture of arms, I could see that would actually be a law. Like, you can't just have your own side business making nuclear weapons, right?
Maybe.
And is it illegal to handle salmon under suspicious circumstances? I think just because of the way it's worded, it sounds very British. So that was a law.
Joe, would you like to say number four in an English accent?
Donna told me not to do any English accents.
Okay.
I'm getting in trouble.
Good my for wife, you, Donna.
I asked my wife before. I said, "What could I say funny when I get up there?" She said, "Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do that." Don't get my sense of humor. It's weird.
Okay. So you did that.
I'm actually going to go to one as having never been a law.
Okay.
I would say the salmon one was on the books and is not no longer on the books.
Okay, yeah, but which one was never
which
a lie?
Which one did I make up?
Number one was never.
Number one.
Number
the
one.
Archery one was never out of the
archery. You're saying that I made it up. That's the thing.
I'm saying that you made up number one.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you, Joe. Bob, what do you got?
All right. So I like
Steve, you know what? I just had something weird happen.
You like it, huh?
I like that feeling. Bob's discomfort in science. Now I know why you love this segment.
I've been saying for years.
Oh, my God. That was so weird.
Yeah, he just, yeah.
It's a rush, isn't it, Trey?
Go ahead, Bob. Keep going.
Okay, so I like Joe's idea about the whole Sunday thing, but practice archery, to me, that's kind of fun. Something that you would kind of do on Sunday. The milkman, yeah, I'm totally buying that because milk, that's pretty important stuff. You know, you just kind of like knock and go away like a UPS guy. You get pissed off. Like, really? I was right here waiting for you. So I could see how that would be very important. The salmon under suspicious circumstances, yeah, that makes a lot of sense as well. I just can't get past three nuclear explosions. What are you going to do? This guy causes a nuke to go off. Then what? You're going to send a cop over. You're going to knock on the door more than once. Like, did you really do this? I'm going to have to take you in, handcuff him.
It's called the constable,
Do you get a warning the first time?
To me, that's just ridiculous. It's like making it illegal to create a portal to another universe. It's like, really, is that really going to be a major concern, putting him in behind bars? So I'm going to say that one is fiction. But in a way, I don't even want to pick that because it's too obvious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that's what you want me to... I'm just going to stop. Nuke fiction.
Mission accomplished, Jay. Well done.
I know, right? It's amazing. I really didn't know if this was going to launch, man.
Jay's on a power trip.
All right.
Enjoy it for two more minutes.
Me?
Steve, go.
So I'm torn.
Wait, stop. Which one did you pick?
Nuclear.
Nuke.
That's fiction. The thing.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, just checking.
What about
right.
Which one was never on the books?
Say again?
That's what I mean. Never
on which one was on the books but not, is no longer on
yeah,
the
yeah, you want to guess any of those? Which ones do you think are current or past?
Do I know how many, what the ratio is?
No.
I'd say the archery and the milk are no longer on the no longer there.
Okay. So I'm torn about the first one because I know, like, being proficient with the longbow was very important to keeping, you know, an army for the nobles, and they would make, you know, the populace practice, because if you didn't practice it all the time, you wouldn't be good enough at it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but the Sunday thing is throwing me, but I think on the balance, I'm going to say that was a law on the books. Milkman knocked twice, that just makes sense. I have the same reaction to the nuclear explosion one to Bob. Why would you bother? You know, why not make it illegal to own, I don't know, fissionable material? You could start with that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Go before the bomb.
It's not like you. It's not like, you know. It's easy to explode a nuclear weapon. You know what I mean? But the only thing is, there may be some technical reason why they had. I mean, it's basically terrorism, right? You could just make terrorism illegal, but still, there may be some weird legal reason why they had to make that a law. But that's bothering me. And the salmon one is just too awesome not to be true.
So nuke.
Oh, yeah, and I think that the one that's no longer on the books is the bow one, and the other two are.
Well, I'll just throw it out there real quick. I think I go with Joe. I think the archery one is the fiction. You made that up entirely.
Okay.
And I think the milkman one and the salmon ones are no longer active. The nuclear explosion one is
You're okay
still.
With the nuclear one.
Okay, I'm going to pull the audience
yes,
now.
Makes sense.
I'm
going to pull the audience. So we're going to do the single clap. When I bring my hand down, please all clap right where my hand gets here. So if you think that men in England are required to practice their archery every Sunday is the fake. If you think it's illegal for milkmen to only knock once. If you think it's illegal to cause I can't pronounce the word.
Nuclear.
If you think it's not if illegal to cause a nuclear explosion.
Wow.
And is it illegal to handle salmon under suspicious circumstances? Let's do that last one again. Okay, got it. Okay, so I'm seeing, I think two and three are kind of tied.
Edge to three.
To three? Okay. So,
start with four.
Yeah, let's take this in, thanks, Steve. Let's take this in reverse order then.
It's helpful.
It is illegal to handle salmon under suspicious circumstances. This one is true law, and it's current.
It's current.
Nice, yes. So far, so good.
The Salmon Act of 1986.
86?
Is an act of Parliament of the United Kingdom passed in 86 which regulates salmon fishery. Section 32 of the Act is headed
handling salmon in suspicious circumstances. This section creates an offense in England and Wales for any person who receives or disposes of any salmon in circumstances where they believe or could reasonably believe that the salmon has been illegally fished. So it's, you get, now yeah, once yeah. you hear that, you're like, okay, so it's protecting fishermen.
Sure.
Yeah. Man, it says it right there in the book, under suspicious
circumstances. You were right, it does sound British.
I love that. Okay, so there you go. Going to three, it is illegal to cause a nuclear explosion. What do you? I just love sitting here.
We're screwed.
Science.
This one is law.
Oh boy!
And it's current law. It's currently law. It's currently law. Good job, Joe.
I'm two for two.
The Nuclear Explosions Prohibition and Inspections Act of 1998. It's not that long ago. Is an act of Parliament of the United Kingdom to implement and enforce the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty of 1996. It is not yet in force, but it's on the books.
All right.
Because they probably haven't figured out how to enforce it, Joe. So here's the meat. The act explicitly declares that to knowingly cause the detonation of a nuke for a test or any other reason will be an offense and punishable by life imprisonment and confiscation of any materials relating to the offense.
That's a good one to include in there.
Oh, isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Okay, is it illegal for milkmen to only knock once?
Good luck.
So who picked this one?
Nobody.
That's the fake. Nobody up here? In the audience?
Half the audience.
I completely made this one up.
Oh!
Whoa!
Good one, Jay.
My rationale was... So I'm going back, I'm thinking, okay, so let's go to the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s. The milkman comes. Now, they didn't even have a bin to put it in, that had any insulation. They didn't. No, I mean, the milkman, in the very beginning, the milkman would come and literally dole it out into mugs and things, right? So I'm thinking, the milkman shows up, probably walked 10 miles to get to the house. If he knocked once and does what the UPS guy does... shit would get crazy after a while. So I figured, let's have him knock a few times, be polite, even open the door. Remember, our mailman used to go into people's houses and drink. He would go into people's liquor cabinets and drink.
Yeah.
He was thirsty. Yeah.
Yeah, Dad told me that story. He would just literally go in, oh, nobody's home.
Yeah, he knew it.
So I made that one up. So good job half of you guys.
Well done.
And then this last one. Now, this last one
is
fun.
They had an advantage, though.
What's that?
They had an advantage.
Yeah.
They live here.
Yeah. But we had milkmen, too.
Yeah, but not English milkmen.
Okay. So men in England are required to practice their archery every Sunday. This was a law.
All right.
It has a long history with lots of changes and everything. You think I'm taking too long?
No.
Okay.
But hurry up.
So the quick answer is this was true once upon a time. It was very important. Good job right here, Steve, for Englishmen to know how to use the longbow to defend England. And then eventually, they had this committee that literally, what's up? What do we want to repeal that's old, old wood in the fire? We got these 400 stupid laws that we're just going to get rid of. And eventually just gotten rid of. But the original plan was, hey, look, every Sunday you got to spend an hour practicing archery in case the French come and we got to take care of them.
Yeah.
That's right. So good job. You half the audience
job,
did a good
guys.
Job. That was a
good
lot
job,
of fun.
Jay. That was
good,
fun.
Jay. Right?
Good job.
When you found that nuclear one, you must have said, holy crap, I'm going to get Bob with this.
I said holy crap to all of them. There was so many. There was a lot of weird ones. Did you guys ever hear of this? That it's illegal for a man to urinate unless he's standing behind his car with his right hand on the back of the car. You ever hear of this? That's fake, completely made up.
What if you're not left-handed? I mean,
there's also the one with the bales of hay in a taxi.
So, Joe, thanks for coming up on stage.
Thanks, guys.
Good job,
awesome.
Good job, Joe.
Boom! Stay in the UK has been fabulous. Everyone has been so nice to us.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah, it really has been wonderful. Our family who is here has really enjoyed it as well. You've been wonderful hosts. We all really hope we can come back soon. And Evan is going to close us out
this
with a quote.
This one's for all of you, every one of you. London goes beyond any boundary or convention. It contains every wish or every word ever spoken, every action or gesture ever made, every harsh or noble statement ever expressed. It is illimitable. It is infinite London. Peter Ackroyd.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.